And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of September 21st, 2020. Today, we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinker. How are you doing, Mariah?
I am doing well and looking forward to pondering some deep questions with you today, Ted, right? We're going to talk about the scientific contract that has been broken, a great article by Naomi Oreskes, and what might science look like in the future. And then also discuss an article by Abram Lustgarten about, as climate hits areas of the United States, where should we live?
Mariah, very interesting opinion editorial piece recently in the, actually in CNN, right, which is not known for its profound editorial stuff. But anyway, Naomi Oreskes, who wrote a book, I think you can probably say it better than I have the title of the book, but she is a scientist at Harvard, has been a social scientist long studying disinformation campaigns, right?
She teaches history of science. Okay. And she wrote, she wrote an article called Why Trust Science, which is fantastic. She also wrote The Merchants of Doubt, which talks really about, you know, this playbook of folks who've sown climate doubt as well as doubt about cigarettes harming you and the ozone layer, all kinds of things. Merchants of Doubt is a fantastic book.
They're probably the same guys that are running around not wearing masks now, right?
Possibly.
But I guess her point in the op-ed was a little bit depressing and a little bit uplifting at the same time. And the basis for it was, she begins with the idea that after World War II, the success of science, basically, in World War II, inventing radar, right, inventing the atomic bomb, which, better not like it or not, was this tremendous technical achievement of the federal government by spending the money and the federal government managing these things. There was this basic, what she calls a science contract, right? And we all have a social contract to live in the society. There's this science contract by which the U.S. federal government would fund big time science through the National Science Foundation, through all the different branches of the federal government, to basically help Americans live better, right? And that has gone on. And from that science contract, at the end of World War II, this sort of social compact, maybe unstated but very, very real, has flown the internet, GPS systems, to the moon, all this stuff.
Vaccinations to deal with deadly childhood diseases, advancing the development of artificial intelligence, understanding why earthquakes happen and how to predict them, you know, making just even our everyday weather forecasts. A lot of this was done in partnership with the government and all based around science.
Right. Medical, everything. So there's huge investment. And her argument is that scientific contract has finally been broken, and that in the contract, which says that politicians in the United States government see science them and to the country, it's just over. It's done. It's, you know, Trump has done it, but Trump is just sort of the last gasp of many people who have been banging away, mostly corporate types, who find that science can be inconvenient, right? And so that we've reached this thing 75 years after the end of World War II, basically we have to admit that, you know, the federal government's not interested in science. I mean, the president today is out last week when you hear this, but he's out contradicting the head of the Centers for Disease Control, telling him he got his timeline wrong about when we're going to get the vaccine. The president knows more than the head of the CDC about medical issues. Right. It's just so topsy-turvy.
I mean, right? Yeah, well, I also appointing the notorious climate science denier David LeGates to run the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Association, which is a he put a huge science denier in charge, a climate science denier in charge of running the organization that studies climate science. I mean, that's a problem.
That's a problem. And her sort of closing point is that, I mean, we can't, it's too late to stand around and talk about how we have to like reestablish the integrity of science and we need to, you know, revalue and recognize the merit of all the scientific stuff that's going on. So basically these guys have killed that, right? And now we're in a new phase and we have to invent something new. And I think it's very interesting because we're heading into a time under a Green New Deal where there's going to be a lot of scientific research, right? Many things are going to be invented, a lot of advances in energy science, presumably. And the question, it's an interesting question. Is under what, what's the right word? What umbrella, what sort of operating principle, what's the big picture about why we're doing this stuff? And how does that justify some use of science that we can all agree to? I put it to you, Mariah. Tell me the answer. I mean, that's a big, I mean,
as an omniscient being that I am, I will figure this problem out. It's hard, right? I think that, you know, is it that there's a lack of understanding about the importance of science? Do we not fully get how you can't have a vaccine for COVID without the science to figure that out? Do we not understand how we, you know, you can't predict hurricanes and earthquakes and, you know, solar eclipses, right? Or lunar eclipses. Well, I think that's a whole big thing.
Are we willing to live in a medieval society?
Yeah. Right?
Are we going to go back to bloodletting? And I mean, in some sense, with social media, everyone's in their own little tribe and believes what they want to believe anyway. All the people with like the mask, the crazy people with the mask that won't wear masks, right? I mean, you get to choose. We're living in a time where you get to choose your own. I mean, this is tired, right? We've talked about this so much. You get to choose your own facts. But I guess the point I would make is that it's depressing on the one hand, what Oreskes has said. It's also exciting because there's new definitions, right? We've talked multiple times now on this show about how post-COVID, right, and sort of post, hopefully post the Trump trauma, we have to rethink a lot of things. Right? And everything's up in the air. This is a moment in history where there's a lot that needs to be redefined. And somehow the relationship between science and the society, or the society and science, I guess, I mean, that's critical, right? How are we going to let that go forward? Is it going to be done in the public interest? Is it all going to be done by corporate guys in labs that patent everything and don't share any information? I mean, It's a topic that certainly we can't answer in this podcast, but which thoughtful people ought to be thinking about, right?
Yeah. Maybe science needs a good, you know, just a good PR person, right? Like remember the Got Milk ads where they had all these celebrities with the milk mustache, right? Maybe we just need a, you know, really good Got Science ad and put it back as a popular thing somehow.
We need another Carl Sagan, maybe.
Yeah.
Or somebody.
That's true.
Anyway, so there's that. So that's just one of those imponderable things that pops up in the post-COVID century, I guess, I suppose. But, you know, that's an interesting thought. It's like you see where people say historically the 20th century did not begin until the end of the First World War, right? So the 1800s actually extended up to 1917 because it was all continuous. Then the war punctuated everything. And after the war, then you had the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. I wouldn't be at all surprised if the 1900s extend all the way up to 2020 and that we're in some sort of a punctuation moment where everything's going to be different afterwards. And we will see let's hope so. Well, let's hope it flows in the right direction.
Yeah.
Speaking of flowing in directions, the other interesting topic that we wanted to get to today is an article in the New York Times that tees off on the idea that both the West Coast is completely shrouded in smoke, as is Boston to some extent. But anyway, the West Coast is nearly unlivable, and the Gulf Coast, Texas, you know, that part of the world is being hammered by hurricanes continuously. And the question is posed as to what are the implications for migration inside the United States? Right, Mariah?
I mean, the guy who wrote this article, It's a long article, but it's very, very good. Do you remember what was it in?
It was in the New York Times, and if you don't have the New York Times, if you can't get past the paywall, it's in ProPublica.
Okay.
I apologize. My printer was so slow, I didn't print out the names of the guys who wrote it, but we'll put a link in.
Well, so it's Abraham Lustgarten, Lustgarten, and he studies, he studies sort of where basically, where might we have to migrate to? He studies a lot of climate migration stuff. And he said one of the questions he gets asked often is basically, where should I live, right? Where's the best place to live that won't be touched by climate? And he takes a big dive into that. I mean, of course, I think that's a fascinating question. I want to know the same thing. Where is the magic place to live? Yeah. So he takes a deep dive into all of the places in the United States and what they might look like in the next 30, 40, 50, 60 years, and how that's going to affect the movement of people, climate refugees, and others.
I mean, what I found interesting was the observation, maybe correct me if I get it wrong, but basically he says that up till now, Americans, so you can have this idea of a climate refugee, right? In my head, for better or worse, climate refugee is a person who lives on the shores of the Indian Ocean in Bangladesh, right? And their small villages have been flooded out in a big hurricane. They have to move inland because they just can't live there anymore, right? He's saying that typically in the United States, not so much climate migrants, but that American citizens with mobility are moving towards the most dangerous climatic places. That is to say, they're moving into the Southwest. They're moving to Phoenix, to Salt Lake City, where there's no water, right? Las Vegas, Nevada is this miracle in the desert, right, where they have millions of people and no water. And it's completely unsustainable. And that's what Americans have been doing, right?
Yeah, moving towards the coast, right, as Florida's been suffering more and more with, roads being completely submerged and unusable. You still have people moving to Florida, as they're getting hit with, pummeled with hurricanes and so forth. That's still, the property values down there are still going strong. Yeah.
And the question is whether or not that trend reverses, right? Whether or not people finally say, oh my God, maybe Salt Lake City, I'm not picking on Salt Lake City, but maybe it's interesting. Salt Lake City and Nevada are kind of close to each other. They're both kind of religious in the sense that Salt Lake is Mormons. Las Vegas is all about gambling and money, right? They all have this great devotion, and they're all out in the middle of the desert with nothing to sustain them other than human ingenuity to keep them. The question is, will people continue to move there, or will that pattern change over the next 50, 60 years, right?
Yeah, he actually sort of speculates that there's starting to be a sort of wake up to that, where you have property values there's a little bit, there's some alerts out there that, wait a second, actually, maybe we need to kind of wake up and change how we are viewing some of these property values that are in places that are sort of destined to be hit hard by climate change. He talks about it almost as if it's like just on the cusp and might quickly turn, where all of a sudden, you thought you had a house that was worth this much and its property values have sunk because this tide just kind of, went. Yeah. All the dominoes started to fall, basically.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things I took out of the article was that in contrast to other places, at least initially, the climate migrants in the United States will be people who have enough money to be mobile and that will move away in the face of declining property values and unlivable conditions, right? There are places where you can't breathe anymore, or you move away if you have the money. So that America would be characterized by not so much forced migration because your home has been destroyed, but by migration by choice, where people move away from areas that they have the money to move away from, and how that will exacerbate inequality, leaving the least advantaged behind in the sort of worst possible climate conditions. it's not a very happy picture. And I think that he points out that even in the great migrations from the south to the north, you know, that ran from the 20s up into the 50s, I think there was some relatively small number, like 6 or 12 people, 12 million people made that migration. It had a huge impact on the north, right, and the south. It had a huge impact on the country. And then now we're talking about many more people potentially moving away from the Gulf Coast and moving away from the West Coast, migrating east and north to places that, you know, maybe marginally better, but who knows, right? I mean, it's a scary proposition.
Everyone's going to move to, he didn't predict this, but he said Duluth, Minnesota, maybe experiencing a surge of climate migrants.
I think, so the article is long, the topic is complex, but it's an interesting one. And again, as thoughtful people, you want to be just aware. Well, we may not be experts in the topic. We should be aware that there are people thinking about it. And it's you to begin to form an opinion is a mark of a good citizen, I suppose I should say, right?
Yeah.
So we'll put it down there, Mariah. What we'll do is put up links to the articles on the blog. It'll be at massclimateaction.org/blog. If you have any ideas about good places to hide out from climate change, please send them to podcast@massclimateaction.net. We'll announce them so the whole world can move to that small town in upstate New York. You can listen to the show directly on your smartphone using all those podcast distribution apps. Please ask your friends. Tell your friends that they can listen to us on their favorite podcast distribution app. We want to thank D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. We want to close where we always close by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. So therefore, we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our future. So, Mariah, thank you for speculating on future real estate deals today.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.